After years of sanctions, Cuba just got closer.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update. Today, new regulations go into effect governing the U.S. relationship to Cuba. Remittances, cash transfers from the U.S. will be much easier. U.S. telecom firms are looking at expanding the Cuban internet and travel. Americans still can't visit willy-nilly, but there are now 12 categories of visitors who won't need a license to travel there, including family visits, education, religious. And how does one get to Cuba exactly? Tim Fitzsimmons reports.
If you search for a flight from the U.S. to Cuba, it's kind of Orwellian. It's as if Cuba doesn't even exist. But the thing is, there are already dozens of legal charter flights every week from the U.S. to Cuba. The two nations even have a civil aviation agreement, though it is from 1953 and badly needs an update, says Julia Swag, the author of Cuba, What Everyone Needs to Know.
Given the regulations, clear opening of the door for commercial travel, it has to be in the near term.
Plus, starting tomorrow, it should be less of a hassle to buy a connecting ticket through Canada or Mexico, since there will be no more cloak-and-dagger cash-only transactions. Fulton Armstrong, a senior fellow at American University, was at the American Interest Section in Havana when the new policy was announced last month. He joked it won't be hard to turn that facility into an embassy.
All we need to do is buy a couple of flags and maybe replace the flagpole.
Here's the bad news. The last time the U.S. thawed relations with a former enemy country was with Vietnam, and updating that civil aviation agreement took 8 years. Then again, Cuba's closer, and a lot more people want to go, so maybe things will be different this time. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
The New York Times is reporting that United Airlines is now trying to get permission to fly directly from Newark to Havana and Houston to Havana. Google is ending sales of its glass eyewear, the heads-up display that linked eyeglass frames to the internet. They were cool, they were dorky, depending on who you asked. The company also said this is not an end of glass. Marketplace's Adam Allington has been looking into this. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning.
For starters, tell me what's going on here. Is the company pulling Google Glass because of lack of interest?
Well, it's not clear. What Google is saying is that this is just the end of the beta testing period for the glass eyewear. People here in the U.S. have been able to buy the headsets for about 2 years at $1,500 a pop. Now, regular folks like you and me won't be able to do that. The company says they've gotten lots of valuable feedback from users, which they're now going to incorporate into future models. It's really hard to imagine, though, that if the product had been a roaring success, that they would actually stop production for good.
All right, so what is Google doing if it's not scrapping the project altogether?
Google is trying really hard to present this announcement as just another step in the evolution of a great product. But many skeptics are basically saying that glass is dead. For their part, the company's moving the glass team out of its Google X incubator labs to become a standalone division. Google isn't giving a timetable for the launch of new versions. It is worth noting that glass isn't disappearing completely. They still have the Glass at Work program, which allows partners to use the devices in places like hospitals and factories.
All right, so we haven't reached a world quite so quickly where everybody walks around with a little video camera on their eyeglasses pointed at you. Marketplace's Adam Allington, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
The International Energy Agency today forecasts that non-OPEC countries will cut growth in crude production this year, even as OPEC promises to keep pumping with the low prices. Note that this doesn't mean that output will fall. It's about slowing the rate of growth. In the U.S., shale oil companies use hydraulic fracturing, and beyond all the chemicals pumped into the ground, the process requires an enormous amount of sand. Large mines have turned parts of rural Wisconsin inside out, and when officials in Trempealeau County, Wisconsin, tried to limit this, the mining companies got creative, as Marketplace's Dan Weissman reports.
In mid-2013, the Trempealeau County Board declared a year-long moratorium on new mining permits. But the county only regulates mining in unincorporated areas, so mining companies went to some of the cities of Trempealeau County and asked to be annexed, like Independence, population 1,363, now home to two sand mines. Mayor Audie Becker says Independence needed a shot in the arm.
And as you see, there's not a lot of people standing outside that door waiting to bring a GM factory in here.
Sometimes there's cash up front. One company offered $1.5 million to the city of Blair, population 1,379 plus two mines, if the city annexed another site. Cities like Blair and Independence offer more permissive rules for mines than the county does. With annexations, more than half a dozen different ordinances now regulate sand mining in the county.
So it's chaos.
That's Jack Spierstra, who represents a third layer of local government, townships that provide services to rural parts of the county. Land getting annexed into a city like Independence comes out of a township like Lincoln, where Spierstra's the board chair. And when his constituents have problems, like with noise or light from mines that become their neighbors on newly annexed land, they get caught in the middle.
They call the county, and the county says, well, it's in the city jurisdiction. You know, who do you call, you know?
Lincoln and another town are suing Independence to prevent one proposed annexation. The mine site is far from the city limit, connected by a strip of land, and Wisconsin courts have ruled against these balloon-on-a-string annexations before. Meanwhile, Spierster's got a dairy farm to run. He takes a stipend of $400 a month to serve as town chair, and I ask him, is it usually in his job description to negotiate with publicly traded companies?
No. I've done this for 25 years, and in the first 25 years, I probably had contact with attorneys for different things once every 4 or 5 years at the most.
Now, he talks to lawyers 3, 4, 5 times a week. In Trempealeau County, Wisconsin, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
And who just got mugged by the Swiss National Bank? Mugging is one word used after the Swiss let the euro drop like a stone yesterday. If you missed our coverage on the air, it's at marketplace.org. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.